Session number 10252.
Mr. Blanchfield, too.
This rather perturbed me because whatever I might have thought about the state of the camp and the soldiers concerned, and indeed the interpreter, I would have thought that the senior officer had a little more composure. However, I explained again that terms of the Geneva Convention precluded me from having to give any of the information he was asking. And he merely repeated that he was the person to decide there and that he was not going to give me any treatment. So I was stuffed into a cell, a small cell, which they were using, which was been an old police station, obviously, a stone-built small building attached to the camp, with one old filthy cell in with straw on the floor. I went in there and they gave me a shallow bowl of rough red wine. And I had that until the evening. And then he came back with the interpreter and asked me, well, have you been reconsidering? You're obviously an intelligent-looking chap, etc., etc. And have you been considering what you should say to me? And I said, yes, I have, in point of fact. The answer's the same. And he was very cross about it, and he said, well, we're going to keep you here. You are here. Nobody knows you're here, and I'm going to keep you here until I get the information I want. And I said, I can't really see what difference this makes. I'm sure that most other people on the islands, especially the fighters, the German fighters that were attacking us, will have all the information they want about which type of aircraft it was. So he said, I'm not concerned about them, because it made him even worse. I didn't realise at that stage how bad the relationships were between the Germans and Italians, in the sense that the Italians were policing the island and the Germans were presumably doing most of the fighting. And I think, being the type of person the Germans are, they probably let them know about it. So there I was, stuck between, if you like, a nutcracker. And I didn't really know what to do. I was very tired. I was a bit weak from loss of blood. I was very lightheaded. And I really was considering what I could do. I had no intention of giving any information whatsoever. But I was trying to find some method by which I could get some relief of some sort. So I struck upon a small thing and I thought, well, it's worth a try. This fellow, the interpreter, was so ridiculous with his English that I thought, well, perhaps if I give him some false information, I can blame it later on the fact that he didn't understand what I was talking about. So when he came back to ask me, had the pannier of wine was empty, and did I want some more? That's all I had. I said yes, and I've decided I ought to tell the Ecomascento something about what was happening. He said, oh, very good. So he took me out of the cell and went. We went herring down the corridor again into the Comicento, who, rather like a Gilt and Sullivan character, put his uniform on again. I mean, I was in tatters, actually, rags and tatters. And he put his uniform on and sat at the desk and said, yes. Now, picked up his pen, and I said, well, I have this to tell you. It was a four-engine bomber. They are very new. It was a Huntley Palmer bomber with Pete Preen engines. And I thought, he's going to throw something at me and tell me to get out. And believe it or not, he accepted it. And the chap was translating. And I thought, well, surely if he's been in Soho, in England at all, he must know. But it was a try-on, you see, and they accepted it. So I thought, right. And they took me back. He said, thank you very much, and asked me what the courses were. And I said, well, I can't tell you that. We came in from the sea and, you know, generally from the direction of Egypt. That's all I can tell you, the canal zone. I wasn't going to tell him, of course, that we had taken off from Fayed, which is on the canal zone itself. But anyway, they put me in the cell again, and I was given bread and clean water. I was given some olive oil for my wounds, and I said, well, can I have some medicaments? And he said, no, we haven't got anything like that. Tomorrow I take you to farther down the coast, and down to Sparkia, a place called Sparkia on the coast, where I, SPH that is, by the way, ARKIA, and where perhaps you can get some treatment from a doctor. Well, didn't seem to be in a very great hurry, so I sat down musing again and looking at myself, feeling rather sorry for myself, when suddenly there was an enormous commotion in the corridor, and the fellow came charging back like an overraged bull, and he said, I've been consulting with my interpreter. This is a lot of rubbish, he said. The interpreter said, absolutely all rubbish, all rubbish. He said, these things you tell me, these names, they're all biscuits and factories and things like this. And I said, oh, really? No, well, they must have told me wrong. And of course, I couldn't really keep up the pretense, so I'm afraid I got rather badly cuffed about. They lost their patience entirely. And it didn't do any good. I fell over on the floor again and opened one or two wounds that had been rather quiescent. So I was feeling very happy when, after dark, time was going on and nothing seemed to be happening, and then suddenly I heard a 4x4, a staff car type of thing, coming along the coast road. We're obviously near the coast, and I could see the headlights. It came round, and I thought, oh dear, and it lit up as it came round. The headlamps lit up the cell, and it drew up outside the place. And I had my German's quite good, and I've been travelling in Germany quite a bit with my father. It's quite good. And I said, well, I heard the commotion going on, and suddenly I heard a German voice, Boris der Flieger. And I thought, good Lord, this sounds very much like the Luftwaffe. And then again, raising decibels, Boris der Flieger. And there was clamp, clamp, clamp down the stone steps. The door was flung open, and the Herr Kommerschenter, with his uniform on, was telling, it was very dark in the cell, of course, there was no light. And the person who was with obviously the German person who was with the Ecomoscento, flashed the torch in and said, took one long look at me. His torch travelled up and down. I don't know what sort of a scarecrow I must have appeared, but he looked at me and said, is this the Flieger? Is this the flyer? And the Ecomoscento said, yes. In German, he said, yes, sir. And I've never seen anybody get so mad. The Germans started reaching for they all carry, as you probably know, the little piston on their belt. And he started undoing the flap, and he said, I can't, well, I'll repeat. He said, Verflucht, which is very bad. That's where I went, Verflucht. He said, Verfluchten Schwein. He said, Du Italienisch, Verfluchten Schwein. He was calling the Italian very bad pig. And he said, and he was fumbling with his holster, and I thought he was going to pull his gun out and shoot him on the spot. He said, you know, you shouldn't treat anybody like this, and you treat a flyer like this man who was shot down yesterday. And he repeated the word I just said. And the Herr Kommerschenter was obviously not very happy about all this. He didn't seem to be going to do very much, and the interpreter disappeared altogether, I think, in case the Wernisch wasn't he shooting, he might get caught in the middle. And he said, come with me, you know, come with me. Verstehen Sie Deutsch? And I said, ja, Herr Boss. Yes, a little. I wasn't going to tell him how much I understood. And he said, come with me. And I went in. And he took me then, he was a Luftwaffe major, and he took me down to Heraklion, where we'd been bombing, and I saw the colonel in charge of the aerodrome there. He was an excellent man in the sense that he treated his frontline soldiers. He had treatment for myself, and he said, we also have your observer here, Robinson, and we have had to do emergency surgery for him, shorten his leg because he had such bad bone injuries. And Robinson is still alive, and he was very grateful to them for what they did for him, allowed him to come back eventually after POW and start his life again. And I was sent, as he was, 2 days later, onto a JU-52, which we'd been trying to bomb, to Athens with the wounded from the Africa Corps. And from there on, we went into a hospital in Athens. And, well, that was really the start of the escaping episodes, because I had a go from there, but I was in such a bad state physically that I had my leg by this time was in plaster and my stitches in my head, and I wasn't in a condition to go very far. So that's another story, anyway.
So you attempted to escape in Athens?
Well, in Athens, the hospital, they were all very much pro-British, the staff, supervised by German, but very much pro-British. And if I'd have been, I tell you quite certainly that if I had been in a position to have taken advantage of that which was put before me, like leaving open doors at the bottom and getting me down out of the wall in, probably going in, one of the suggestions was I could get in with all the dirty linen, they'd take me out with that, things like that. So I don't know. I think that was a great chance missed. But then again, we have to take advantage of what we can. I wasn't in a position to take advantage of that. So I'd walked out into the street, and I'm sure that I've been looked after. I'm sure that they would have looked after me extremely well. There was a very good escape organisation operating in Greece at the time, and not only that, the people themselves were very, very pro-British.
Then you were taken to Germany, were you?
Yes, I went on to a train, a rather marvellous run. It was took us about 7.5 days. We got on a train and a wood fire job that went over Mount Olympus and with all the Africa Corps wounded, and went right through all the Balkan states, Sofia, Belgrade, all the way through right to Austria and Vienna. And on the way, well, it was September, remember, and it was beautiful evenings, and we used to get out in the evenings, and the Africa Corps used to get out, and there wasn't any animosity between all of us. We were all doing the same job, different sides. And that's the first time I heard the song Injam, Lili Marlena, because I hadn't heard it, of course, and nobody had any. It was a German's tune, and of course it came down eventually to the 8th Army and then on to Britain.
And
in Vienna, they went one way, of course. We were looked after by the German Red Cross, and they went one way to their various hospitals, and we went another. We went into a POW camp. We went to Dulag Luft, which is a reception for all aircrew and interrogation centre. And having already had a taste of interrogation, albeit by the Italian army, I was very impressed by the German methods. I mean, their methods are entirely different. They got you in there, and they got you in a small room, and Sonderführer, who was an interpreter, came in. He was fluent English, Oxford accent, and got out all his gold flake and his whiskey and stuff, which obviously had come from Dunkirk or something like that, and was very, very friendly and made a great fuss and dance about everything. And with me, of course, it was not only sort of, would you like to fill this form in? I mean, everybody had the same. And you looked at it, and it was a bit odd, and they said, yes, but squadrons on here, you've got squadron, and all that, and where we operate from. Oh, we know all about that. He said, we know. But this is, you understand, for the Red Cross purposes. They, in Geneva, they have to have all this so that they can pass on, they agree that you're genuine, and they can pass on the information to your family, you see. So it didn't quite ring true. Didn't quite ring true to most of us, and we put things on like drop dead and things like this, you know, things like silly things really in a way, but you must remember that we were under some pressure and we were not going to lightly give in or give way to anything of that description. But of course they had methods. They surfaced, saturated some of the chaps with them. Let's be fair, everybody reacted differently in those circumstances, and there were reasons why they did so. I mean, some people are stronger than others, some people don't pick up quickly the subterfuge that's used for these things, and it was amazing, because later when I reviewed this, I could see that by small things on each, tiny things that people let drop, amazing that they must have put together the most amazing, not kaleidoscope, sort of mosaic of information, which gave them an awful lot towards the end of the day. Because after my first interrogation, which didn't go very far, and he saw I wasn't very cooperative, I was put back in the cooler for about 3 days, and then come out, and another chap came, half-colonel, and he said, "Now, I know you understand some German." He said, "I want you to understand this, that you're not giving any information at all. We know all about you. We know what squadron you're on. You're on 76 squadron. We know where you flew from, middle of St. George. We knew you went to, you went via Gibraltar to Fayed in the canal zone in June." And, I mean, I was sitting there literally with my mouth dropping open. And he said, "I know your commanding officer, who your commanding officer was. First of all," he said, "you had New Zealand commanding officer, and now you have Wing Commander Young." And he said, "I even know one of the girls' names at the in Darlington, in one of the," he said, you probably use his, "I don't know that much, but you probably use one of the hotels in Darlington. You use the Imperial, did you?" I said, "Yes, I did, as a matter of fact." And he said, "Well, Betty was there, wasn't she?" And I thought, well, I don't really know. He said to me, you played for London Irish before the war, rugby, didn't you? I didn't know what to do, you know. I said, well, if you know all that much, then it's not much point in me telling you anything anyway, is there? I mean, you know more than I do. Oh, he told me that my full group was at York, and he told me who was in charge of it. I said, well, you know more than I do, so not much point in me wasting your time or mine, really. I can't tell you anything. He said, oh, you'd be surprised. I said, yes, I expect I would. Anyway, so we went on to this, and cigarettes were coming out. I didn't smoke, and whiskey and chocolate. and biscuits and things like this, and tea and coffee and all Red Cross stuff, or what they'd purloined from. So we had, but they were very technical, they were very subtle, and they were very, very good, and their English was absolutely impeccable. So I can understand that some people that weren't quite quick, perhaps on the uptake, or were feeling down, because to be fair, a lot of people were feeling very much down at that stage. I mean, everything was going against them, they'd been shot down, they couldn't get back, they didn't expect, nobody ever gets expected to get shot down, they may have been injured badly, or they had a rough time, like a fellow called Ginger Pape, who came through Holland, and they knocked off all the people that he tried to contact, and then eventually finished up, and they smashed him all over the place. So I can imagine, he didn't give in, but I can imagine people giving in to pressure, physical and mental. And I can't say it, I would hope I never would, and later on, when I had occasion to be tested very hard in Krakow, in prison there, I managed to hold out. But I must say that there were some days when I very much doubted I could see the next day through in that context.
So at Gulag Luft, did you come across any British personnel who were actually helping the Germans, acting in a role?
Rather a strange question to ask. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I expect you've heard. Yes, I did. Gulag Luft was a camp when we got there. Remember that we'd had none of us any ideas of what a prisoner of war camp would be like. Yes, there were. There was a what they called a permanent staff there. And I put quite a bit in the book about it because I feel it should be said. So the officers and people that were coming through in transit, yes, that was a great transit camp, interrogation transit camp. But the permanent staff were there for obviously reasons best known to themselves and wanting to ensure that they had rather a better time. All the parcels and all the food going to that camp from Red Cross was pooled. Germans ensured that you pooled it. Their suggestion, their reason, they said, was because you couldn't keep tins to go and escape and things like this. You couldn't keep food and store it for escaping. But really it was a different matter. The food wasn't too bad, but the permanent staff were absolutely living like, well, down at the Ritz, as it were, you know, they had their own quarters and everything. And whilst, okay, if you're doing a permanent job like that, you're entitled to a little perks, perhaps, but it ran not to food so much, although everybody was pretty hungry. I mean, they'd been on the loose and on different ways for a long time in different prisons, perhaps after they were captured, and some with resistance in France and been retaken and had a rough time coming down. So we were all pretty hungry. Our stomachs hadn't shrunk then. But there were other things, such as small escape. We were all, a number of us were hotheads in that respect, go-aheads, and we were all trying to find different ways. As a matter of fact, Wing Commander Bader was there when I was there, and he was a chap I very much found straight down the line on all this, and I used to say to him, well, damn it, that thing's gone for Burton again, you know, somebody must have told them, and he used to say, yes, I'm afraid this is the situation, and we have to try and contain ourselves. Those that know about something, keep it within your own cell, and we are made cells of five, and outside that, little did we know then, but it was on the old resistance network, same framework there. Cells of five, and then if you had anything to tell the next cell, you one person told them, and you noted when it was done, that sort of thing. But until then, several things had happened, and one person was shot on the wire, and, you know, I had a personal experience, which wasn't a lot really, but for me, it showed me which way the wind was blowing. I had a bad abscess on the tooth. I was wanting to get away, and I knew that if I could get away, if I could manage to escape somehow from that camp, I knew that my German would take me some distance if I could manage to steal clothes off a lion behind a house or something. I mean, we had all sorts of queer. I didn't think I'd get far. I had no maps, compasses, or damn all else. Little food. But I was going to have a go. Now, I was thinking in terms of going from the camp and talking about it to one or two people. When my tooth started to go up very badly, and I had an abscess. It was so bad, in fact, the whole of my face was swollen, and my eye as well was almost closed. So the Stabsarzt, the German doctor, said to the British doctor there, you better take him into Frankfurt. Now, we were near Frankfurt am Main. Frankfurt am Main. And I thought, well, now, hang about. This is going to be... Now, here's a chance I'm going to get a... If I don't get too many guards with me, I mean, this is a possible chance. So I needed food. He said, well, I'll sell a postern. They used to call the guards posterns, one guard postern. And watchman. He said, one postern will come for you and we'll take you at 3:30 this afternoon. Now I thought, right. I said, thank you very much indeed. He said, you'll go by train. And I said, thank you. He said, I hope you get on all right. He was all right. He was an administrative officer in the camp, German captain, Hauptmann. And I went round collecting bits and pieces of food, stuffing them in my, getting them into a little place where I put them inside different parts of my battle dress so that I could at least have a little bit of stuff to go across country, as it were. And one of my little cell of five, thinking he was doing the right thing, went to one of the staff that he knew, the permanent staff, and said, well, Terry's going to try and have a go, we're collecting round, we haven't got much, is there anything you can give us? Now, I will never know whether that person passed the information or not, but what I do know is that nobody else was told except my four in the cell, and that person unfortunately went to get help. And I do know that at 2:30 instead of 3:30, the Lagerfeld's Polizei bloke came round. He was a major, he was a field security bloke, and he said, right, I want you straight in here now, I want to interrogate you. He said, you, this afternoon when you go out, you're going to sign a parole, you're going to be put on parole. And he said, well, you're sending three guards and you're going to be put on parole. And he said, you won't want all that stuff you're taking with you either. I said, what stuff? He said, well, you're taking food. He said, stuff I can see it sticking out of your pocket, but he couldn't do anything at all. He said, I know you've got food. He said, you're not going to need that at all. Now, he'd originally said, or rather his subordinate said, I would have one guard, I would go on the train, there was no problem. And now he said, you're going to go in transport with four guards, and you're going to sign a parole. And I said, I'm going to do nothing of the sort. I don't have to sign a parole, and I had no intention of signing a parole. He said, all right, you won't have your face done. And I said, so be it. I shall go to the doctor here, and I shall insist on him putting a report to the, and having the Red Cross person, the next Red Cross person that's coming to the camp, and they visit fairly frequently, I make a full complaint that I can't get the treatment I want. I said, I don't know what this is all about. But in the background, the chap that was concerned, he was also the Vertrauensmann, the competence man, interpreter. It was a sergeant pilot, Hamden pilot, called Slowey, S-L-O-E-Y. And I can't guarantee anything, but I'm just telling you the sequence of events, the chronological order of the happening. And the British officer, who was a captain, I can't remember his name, Meadows, I think, RMC, he was there, he said, look, you better sign this thing. I said, I'm not signing, definitely not signing any form of... I said, I'll tell you this, sir, my foot outside the gate, I'm going to go at the first occasion, I'm going to scalp her. I said, I have no intention of signing anything. He said, well, I'll have to treat you here, it'll be a much worse job. So anyway, we talked about it for about an hour, and I said, will this be... I said, if I sign anything like that, will it be the only occasion? He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll sign a parole for myself, I'll come with you. You needn't sign a parole. So Meadows, which I think his name was, signed his parole, came with me. And even when I was in the dentist chair, these four blokes came in. Two waited in the corridor outside, and then two came into the actual dentist surgery with me, with Meadows, and they were at full threat. They had their Schmeisers and everything. So there must have been a tip-off there, no doubt about it. That's what I have to say about the question you asked me.
Can you tell me which camp you were taken to after Dulag Luft?
Which time I was?
Which camp you were taken after?
Yes, I went to Lambsdorff, Stalag 8B, aircrew compound. And you must remember that my commission hadn't called up with me, and so I was flight sergeant, I suppose. When I say I suppose, I think it was a flight sergeant, I'm not sure. I went to Stalag 8B in the RAF compound. Now, something happened to me which was very fortuitous there. Well, first of all, when we got there, we looked at the camp, and it was a very sinister-looking place. It was huge, and we seemed to be kept quite separately. as I was told by the senior British officer, that this has always happened. Air Force, with their training, were much more competent at escaping than perhaps army people, army other ranks. And so, with compass reading, all that sort of thing. So, what I couldn't understand was opposite us, just opposite in the compound, when we, next morning, when we could look around and see what was going on in the camp, was a number of soldiers with all commando flashes on, with chains on their hands. They were chained up. And so we were told anyway, the person in charge of our compound told us that these were indeed the Dieppe Canadians that had taken part in the raid in 42, quite well in 42. And they'd all come back, and because the Germans had found that some of the prisoners they'd taken, or this was the alleged statement, some of the prisoners had been taken, had their hands tied and they were shot. They were being dealt with the same way. And it wasn't until 10 o'clock that morning that we were all asked to fall in. And lo and behold, we were treated in exactly the same way. I take it that was because we were terror fleegers and we were bombing German cities. So I think the directive was supposed to come from Hitler, but one never knows about these things. However, that was a fact. And for about 2 months we were variously trying to undo pieces of rope, undo pieces of chains, take them off when the guards had gone out the building, put them back on when they came back at night. It was a real caper. It was quite a thing, really. We treated it all as a bit of a prank, but the chains weren't too bad, but when we were tied, they didn't have many chains left when we got there, and they tied us very tightly with rope. And if you can imagine being tied very tightly with rope all day, not only the chafing was bad, but circulation was difficult. And already we weren't in such good. There were no Red Cross passes in the camp at that stage, or at least they may have been getting them in the other parts of the army compound. We most certainly weren't getting them. That was one of the things as well. We only had just a bare turnip soup, half a litre, and so many grams of black bread. That's all we had a day, with two or three potatoes in the evening. So after about a couple of months of this, I hadn't been in very good nick when I got there. And very good, I'm saying nick, I mean, I wasn't very fit with all the stuff that happened to me. And I began to grow very large. I had, on my bottom of my legs, I had big carbuncles. And I went to a British doctor, and he said, well, he said, I'll send you to the lazarette, which was over in the main compound, German administrative compound, and working compound. And I went over there, and I walked in, and I shall never forget the day. I walked in and I saw this chap bending down dealing with cases, and I thought, looks familiar. He had battle dress on, but he had his RAMC cap on. Looks familiar. And when it came to my turn, I looked round a bit and he looked at me. He said, good God. I said, good God. It was Gordon McRae, who was captain of the RAMC. He used to play fullback for London Scottish when I played on the wing for London Irish. And we knew each other extremely well. And he said, God, I never thought I'd see you again. I said, well, here we are and here I am. What can you do for me? He said, well, I'd do something about those legs for a start. So I went into his lazarette and went to bed, and he performed upon me. And whilst I was there, I said, what